The Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Morning, members, and we've asked the Department of Corrections to take about 15 minutes or so to address the committee relative to the Legislative Auditor's Report on Substance Abuse Treatment that specifically relates to the Department of Corrections. And then we'll start with your biennial budget once you've completed this section. So I don't know if members still have their Legislative Auditor's Report, but we'll... And can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Department of Corrections. And given that this report's about a year old, we've had some real good opportunity to implement a lot of the recommendations. So I'm here to provide you with a quick update of how we have implemented those recommendations. We also have a backgrounder on our CD treatment programs in prisons. We'll pass around. We found the report to be extremely useful for us. It pointed out some areas of improvement for us, but also affirmed some ideas that we had about where we wanted to take our CD programs. The department is really proactively striving to improve its CD treatment outcomes through the provision of a continuum of CD services. And so I think what you'll find is that we have started providing that continuum in a much more comprehensive way. One of the major recommendations of the report was sharing of information. We have struggled over the past number of years with a federal law that prohibits us from sharing treatment information with non-clinicians or without the consent of the offender/patient. So last year, the legislature implemented a new statute really proactively telling us to share that information with supervising agents. We have provided training to our staff, we've changed policy, and we are well on our way to ensuring that the supervising agents in the community get the treatment information that they need about the offenders as they're being released. We have implemented several enhancements to CD collection efforts. We do have a CD evaluation project that we're working on. It's very long-term in nature, and so therefore we won't see the results of that for several years. But basically, the process has two phases, a process evaluation as well as an outcomes evaluation. The process evaluation is going to investigate the program resources and activities, and then, of course, the outcomes evaluation will link the program activities to long-term and short-term outcomes. It will also provide additional information on our program, such as reasons for failure or refusal for treatment, areas of excellence, which of our programs, because some of them are a little bit different than others, which of our programs seem to have better outcomes than others, and then areas that, of course, need improvement. So we're looking forward to that. As I mentioned, that evaluation project is going to take some time, so we are looking to put together a separate short-term evaluation project that will address the question to the extent which our programming, our CD programming, reduces offender recidivism. And our research unit is spearheading that effort. The report recommends that the department obtain evaluation of our CD programs by outside entities. And we have we have continued to have the Departments of Human Services, the Department of Public Safety, and, of course, our staff go in and evaluate three of our programs during this past year. We implemented rules by which our programs are certified. The rules were jointly developed by the Departments of Human Services, Public Safety, and us, and they're based on DHS's Rule 31, which is the certification rules for CD programs in the community. However, ours add kind of that unique component that recognizes that treatment in a prison is a little bit different than treatment in the community. So our rules are that. And as I said, over the past year, we've had three of our programs recertified by those three entities. Building a continuum of care. The report suggests that a continuum of services, including pre-treatment and aftercare services, will help to prevent relapse. We agree on that, and so we have targeted some resources to providing a strong aftercare component in our minimum units. What we are striving to achieve is front-end loading treatment so that those folks who are minimum eligible will get out to minimum a little bit sooner and then remain in that minimum unit for 2-3 years in a kind of sober house environment. We will be providing a strong aftercare component using community-based treatment programs so that that relationship is built between the offender and the community-based program prior to them being released. We find that that's probably one of the most successful ways of integrating somebody into the community. Oh, one of the other opportunities that we have to improve the continuum of care is to really enhance our completion of Rule 25 assessments while the offender is still with us. We obviously need trained assessors who can do that. We do have some, and our MCORP reentry initiative is also focusing on the need for Rule 25 assessments, and then we might be able to increase the number of Rule 25 assessments done on our offender population as they're coming out of prison. Availability of resources. About 85% of our offenders are directed to treatment, and you'll see some of these same statistics in the backgrounder. About 85% of our offenders are directed to treatment, and we certainly don't have enough beds in order to treat everybody, and certainly not everybody has enough time to spend with us in order to receive treatment. The department estimates it needs about 1,200 additional beds to treat those offenders. The cost of those beds would probably be about $1.1 million per 100 beds. So that's kind of what the kind of the highlights of what we have done in terms of implementing some of the recommendations in the report. One of the report recommendations was also that we move from short-term programming to long-term programming, kind of getting away from that psychoeducational programming to something that's a little bit more effective. And Mr. Allen will talk a little bit about the impact that that's had on our system and why we agree that it was the right thing for us to do.
Carson, can I just ask you really quickly? So you need 1,200 beds, is what your testimony is, and the cost of that is $1.1 million additional?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, if we were to treat everybody who was directed to treatment, if we were to treat everyone who was directed to treatment, we would need about 1,200 beds, and the cost of that would be $1.1 million per 100 beds, so about $13
million. So
$13.2
million. And, Ms. Byerson, what are you requesting for chemical dependency treatment in the institutions for the biennial budget?
Mr. Chair, we did put in an operating budget request for some new beds up at our CIP, up at Willow River, and I think it was 90? Yeah, it was about 90 beds up at Moose Lake, or Willow River, I'm sorry. And then there was some dollars for programming up at Moose Lake. So,
Mr. Chair, Dennis Benson, I'm the Deputy Commissioner. The other area where we were able to add beds to the system just this past summer without additional dollars was the Prairie Correctional Facility, the privately held facility. They've got a 24-bed program that is analogous to the same kind of treatment model that we have inside of our system.
So, Commissioner, I'm just trying to get does the department not see this as a priority, or does it lower on the priority list in terms of resources? It just seems to me you have a long way to go to meet the need.
Mr. Chair and members, we certainly don't. If you take a look at the chart on the second page of the handout. I think the numbers from 06 to 08, we are adding 121 beds. The other thing I would submit is that while we need additional beds to accommodate the 80% or so that are abused chemicals that come into our system, we also have to be realistic about how many of those beds we can add at any given time, given the training curve, the recruitment curve, adding those beds to our system, finding the appropriate program space. It's much more complicated than just finding the dollars for treatment. We'd like to have closed units. We'd like to have what seems to work, and our experience would suggest that inpatient treatment works. The other thing that we've been working on the past couple of years is this this model of aftercare at our minimum custody units, and that has taken us some time to try to get people into treatment a little bit sooner during their sentence, so that there is time for this sober house aftercare phase that we really believe does pay dividends. So we are, I think, transforming where we have gone or where we've been to where we want to go with respect to chemical dependency. We've also cashed in those educational beds for longer-term inpatient treatment beds. And for a system of our size, we are in much, much better shape than most states with respect to the number of inpatient treatment beds. So this next biennium, we will be adding 90 beds at CIP up at Willow River, and I believe that you're going to tour that this Friday. I'm sure you'll be impressed with that program. In addition to that, we're getting the minimum aftercare component up and running. We are working with our partner out in Appleton, Minnesota. The first offenders just graduated from that 24-bed program. And I believe we're also adding some additional CD beds inside of Moose Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Using existing funds. And we also just added 12 beds, as you heard, out at Stillwater this past summer in the Atlantis program. In that we double bunked 12 of those rooms in a treatment unit. We believe that that's the right thing to do. So by no means do we see this as a low priority, but there, as you also know, there are many competing priorities. The other piece to this puzzle, of course, is reentry, prisoner reentry. We can do all these things inside of our facilities. If we can give them primary treatment, give them some months at minimum custody, and we have about 500 minimum beds system-wide, and then move them into the community and make sure that that is a smooth transition. We believe that that's a prescription for success for many of these people. And the model that we point to is the CIP model, where they're released, treated, they have a home, they have a job, they have aftercare, and they have very good supervision. So that's sort of the direction that we want to take, not only chemical dependency, but transitioning people, and by and large, they're all chemically release them treated, give them some sober house environment, and then transition them to a community setting.
Commissioner, just to follow up on that, or Ms. Larson, that one of the findings in the report said that prison release plans for inmates assessed as chemically dependent have provided minimal direction regarding post-release substance abuse assessment and programming. So are you saying that this is something that you're going to do differently in the future, or something that you're doing differently now, because the findings don't seem to support that you're doing it?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Larson.
We have added CD release planners to our CD program specifically for that. So we do have some CD release planning, comprehensive release planning efforts underway. Obviously their efforts will be to do the Rule 25 assessments to ensure that there's appropriate treatment set up for them while they're, as they enter into the community. And then it goes to housing and employment and getting them enrolled in one of the state's public health care programs. So there is some comprehensive release planning occurring.
Representative Diskins, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have two, if you'd indulge me. First is to Ms. Larson. Ms. Larson, I just need a further clarification. I'm not quite sure I heard you correctly, but is the 1,200 beds additional above what we already have? In other words, is the department saying that what the need is about 2,100 beds, or is the 1,200 beds the total need, and seeing as there's already about 900, that'd be an increase of 300 beds?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Diskins, we need an additional 1,200 beds.
Okay.
For a total of 2,100.
Thank you.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you. That clarifies that. I guess my other question is, as I look at the department's CD treatment budget and do just some quick math, compare that to the number of beds, you have 900 beds at a cost of $4.5 million. Your request for additional beds, and just some quick math, that's about $500,000 per 100 beds. But you said in testimony that to add, for every 100 new beds that you add, it's going to come to $1.1 million for each new bed, more than double the cost. Can you explain how you come up with that figure?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Diskins, we have to provide a certain staffing ratio for programs that are certified as primary treatment. I believe it's a one CD treatment staff person to every 12 offenders. That requires us to have about 13 or 14 staff for every, 13 or 14 staff for every 100 beds that we have. So it has everything to do with those treatment ratios that we have to have there. There's and that's based on our certification rule. So,
Representative Diskin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but Ms. Larson, that doesn't explain the discrepancy. The discrepancy, then what it begs the question is, are the treatment ratios not being met right now, or are you doubling the ratio? I don't understand why right now 100 beds, current cost is costing you about $500,000 for 100 beds. But to add more beds, you're telling this committee that for each 100 new beds, it's $1.1 million to add that. And it can't be tied up in the staffing ratios unless current staffing ratios are being violated.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Diskins, I can't explain all the math, but I know one small piece of this is the 24 beds out at the Prairie Correctional Facility are simply part of the contract, so those 24 beds are not part of the mix. I think the other issue is, in addition to the primary therapist in the units, there's also in some of the cases of existing treatment programs, there's unit directors that provide part of that service that are already on staff but not part of that budget. They're part of the institution budget. Up at the Willow River program, while we need the ratio of primary treatment staff, we already have built into that program the other infrastructure that you need for a treatment program, so we will not have to duplicate that piece of it. So, you know, we have some infrastructure in place in existing treatment programs that are not part of the chemical dependency budget, but going forward, when you're talking about, for instance, going to Oak Park Heights, which has no treatment program, some of those pieces would have to be added, so that's part of the additional cost. But we can certainly go back and take another look at our map and come back to this committee with a line item budget with respect to the need for the 1,200 additional beds. Same for the aftercare and our minimums. We have some pieces of that in place in the minimum units, but as you start to add many, many treatment components, at all the minimums, we're going to have to add additional infrastructure.
Thank you, Commissioner Representative Biskins. We plan on doing an extensive evaluation with DOC about the rising health care costs, and this would be included in that, so we want to get the numbers correct, and we will provide the committee with all correspondence that comes from DOC relative to this. Representative Hillstrom, I think you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're not requesting enough treatment beds, and you're saying that you're working on a plan to take people who have success inside to then to minimum and then to an outside, what are you doing for those that don't get treatment that are inside? I mean, then how do you decide who gets treatment inside and who doesn't? Is it based on the availability of treatment when they get out, or, you know?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, when someone enters our system, they are assessed by a CD assessor, as well as a variety of other people, and they're pretty much given a score as to their need for treatment, high risk, high need, low risk, low need. And based on that, we have a waiting list, kind of a centralized waiting list, that's administered by one person, and that person kind of looks and makes the determination whether or not that person needs to go into treatment. There are a number of other extenuating factors, such as discipline issues. Are they ready for treatment? Can they read? Do they have the right kind of education? Can they speak English? So there's a variety of extenuating circumstances, but we do have a centralized waiting list that is prioritized based on their treatment needs, high risk, high need, low risk, low need. And that's how we send somebody to treatment. We have to use a prioritized list because we don't have sufficient beds to treat everybody, so we use that prioritized list.
Ms. Hillstrom?
Thank you. Just then the second part of that question was, then what do you do to ensure that these people that don't get treatment inside actually do get it on the outside?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, one of our goals with our CD release planners is to actually work with those folks who have not received treatment to ensure that they are connected with a treatment program when they're on the outside, and do get a Rule 25 assessment so that they're eligible for consolidated treatment fund monies and that. So it will be part of the work of the CD release planners to help us with that. Certainly, we can't hit everybody. And we do have some other reentry efforts underway through the MCORP, initiative, and they too will be working on Rule 25 assessments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dominguez.
Just to follow up on what you just mentioned, are you working with a lot of community organization CD programs?
Ms. Larson.
Some of those that don't speak English and have, you know, different needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dominguez, that's one of our initiatives for our aftercare programming, is to work with those community-based programs, and we will try to get as culturally appropriate as we can.
Representative Beeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Larson, you made one comment, and I was just, I'm not sure I caught it. You said you have three programs that are certified by DHS. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, no, all of our programs have been certified by the Department of Human Services. We recently recertified three of them this past year.
Okay. that was my one of my questions. Okay, another question is, do you distinguish between long-term and short-term treatment programs? Is there any way that you distinguish that in the system?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, we used to have long-term and short-term programming. We moved away from that. And as the OLA's report mentioned, shorter-term treatment is not nearly as effective as long-term, and we were moving in that direction anyway, found that to be true as well. So we moved away from short-term treatment and now have all long-term.
I was just reading on your report here and your comments, and it says approximately 3,500 new commits enter prison with sentence sufficient to complete long-term. And so 85% are directed to treatment. What does it mean when you direct them to treatment, and why is it only 85%?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, being directed to treatment means that when you come in, you get an assessment through our intake process, and it says, oh, yep, you're chemically dependent or chemically abusive, and you need some treatment. Why is it only 85%? Because the other 15% don't have an issue with chemicals.
Representative Eastland?
Okay, I guess, am I reading something wrong? And it says approximately 3,500 new commits.
Yeah.
Offenders and release violators enter prison usually with a sentence sufficient to complete long term. So that's just referring to their sentence. So that they have a long enough sentence so that they could actually fit it in.
That's correct.
Okay.
Long term treatment is somewhere between 6 months and a year.
Okay, and then one final question, I think. When you say you're funded to treat 1,800, how does that work? You've got 1,800 and some entering treatment. You've got 1,181 that are actually finishing it. Talk a little bit about how that works just mechanically in the system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, as somebody enters treatment, obviously somebody else is finishing. So we can turn over the beds to sufficiently treat about 1,800 people. It's really treatment opportunities. However, not everybody is going to finish treatment for a variety of reasons. They may fail treatment. They may decide that they don't want to be in there any longer. Therefore, we only get through about 1,100.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Eastland.
Are all 1,800 beds full all the time, or what is kind of the turnover rate, and is the program running at maximum capacity? Are the beds filled at all times?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, we have about 900 treatment beds, and so because average length of treatment is somewhere between 6 and 7 months, we can turn those beds over. Are they full all the time? You know, it takes a couple days to move people around. We do use pre-treatment. And sometimes if we don't have sufficient staff because of staff turnover, we have to hold some beds open, but we do have about 1,800 treatment opportunities a year.
There's four or more members who have questions or opportunities.
I'm just intrigued that the number of people that would qualify for treatment is so much higher. What we're doing is we're turning out about a third, or not, a little less than a third, of the people that actually would be directed to treatment each year. If 3,000 are directed, we're turning out 1,100 out of treatment, and we have 900 beds. Another 1,200 beds would get us a little bit closer, but still wouldn't get us there in terms of and then along with that. Is there any place for a program that would be more mandatory rather than just voluntary?
Commissioner Jensen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, at the risk of sounding a little bit defensive here, I just have to remind members of what happened to our prison population in the last 11 years. It almost doubled in 11 years. And in the middle of that 11-year cycle, we, as you all know, experienced a dramatic budget downturn. And I certainly appreciate the interest in this topic. It's one that's not only important to me, but very personal to me, as I'm sure it is to many of you. Treatment is, if we do nothing else, we should be releasing people treated who have a chemical dependency problem. This agency is committed to that goal, but we are catching up. Our growth has stabilized a little bit the last year or two. We're still increasing, but only a couple hundred a year, 250 a year. We're adding beds as we can logically add them to physical plants. Again, it's more complicated than just finding the bed and finding the treatment staff. It's training. It's finding treatment staff who are certified. So certainly this agency, if you look at the numbers from 2006 to fiscal year 08, we are adding beds, and it's our intention to continue to add beds. The other thing I don't think we can lose sight of is it's way more complicated than just that primary treatment. I believe, again, based on personal experience, that the magic is the aftercare. Anybody can space over 30 days at Hazleton. That isn't the challenge. The challenge is how to live that sober life. And I think this notion of adding 500 aftercare beds at our minimum custody units is critically important to the whole reentry initiative. We must release people not only treated, but knowing how to begin living that life sober. And that's also what has been, I think, part of the magic of CIP, Representative Eastland, is there is a motivator there. If they complete this, they can get out of prison a little bit early. And the carrot and stick really seems to work in the contents of that context of that program. And there is an aftercare component that is required for phase two of CIP. They not only graduate treated, but now they're going to a community, and they must participate in CD aftercare. Required treatment, you know, again, my experience would suggest that just about everybody who enters treatment, and I'll quote a therapist that I worked with respect to my oldest son, said, you go into treatment with a boot up your butt. Most of us who end up in treatment, we're not going there because we want to sober up. It's the courts, it's a wife, it's parents. There's somebody that's motivating these people to go into treatment. And for some of them it works, for others it doesn't. The other thing that we know is that about most people, it takes somewhere between two and three tries before they sober up. And some relapse, some don't. But again, I think that this continuum of not just the primary treatment, but the aftercare and getting them into a community setting where they have those wraparound services is critically, critically important. And we certainly understand your disappointment that we are only releasing about a third of the people treated. We see that as a problem and a challenge as well, but I think that we are moving in the right direction. Certainly, if bags of money started falling out of the sky, we would add additional treatment beds. But again, I think we have to do that methodically. We have to also look at all pieces of the spectrum here as opposed to just adding treatment beds. I think what I'd like to see is real success with the third that we are releasing, and we're starting to see that. We're starting to see that with CIP, and I believe we're going to see that as we put some teeth into sober environments at our 500 minimum security beds. So I believe we're on the right track here. We will continue to work with you with respect to adding additional beds. We know we need to do that. But again, compared to most correctional systems, 6 months of inpatient treatment in prisons is almost unheard of nationwide. And we're very, very fortunate to, that we have policymakers that understand that it takes a longer period of time for this population. It's way more complicated than somebody who doesn't have that criminogenic personality that we also have to deal with. So we appreciate your support, and certainly the direct questions are all fair questions, and we look forward to working with you to increase that number of those that we release treated.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a few more questions here, and then we really wanted to get started with their budgets. So, Representative Mullery, you were next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions came up from other questions. Following on Representative Dominguez, my understanding is what your answer to him was, you have aftercare programs, works with communities of color. My concern is that there's quite a few statistics that show that at least some, for instance, Southeast Asians respond because of their culture differences to people that are very experienced in that culture and treating them, and it sounds to me like you don't bring that in until later. And what are you doing to, why aren't you up front bringing in these cultural differences into the treating?
Ms. Lassen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, I think if we could wave a magic wand and get culturally diverse licensed chemical dependency counselors, we certainly would. It has been a challenge actually just recently due to licensing requirements of CD counselors to ensure that we even have appropriately licensed staff. As of January 1st of 2007, anyone who's providing direct CD treatment has to be licensed by the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. So we would love to be able to get culturally diverse CD treatment staff. We're working with our Office of Diversity to ensure that, you know, we're trying to reach as many folks as we can who might meet those criteria. But getting licensed treatment staff is really tough anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate it if outside of this hearing we could look into that. Maybe maybe we can figure out a way to work some of the experienced people from the culture that work with drugs. I don't know if they have technically every license you require. Maybe there's some way to work that together. My initial question was going to be, is there a way with determinate sentencing that we can incentivize them, such as if they don't participate, can we keep them from getting out immediately for their last third? Or if they're doing a really good job, can we incentivize them the other way and have them on some kind of a work release and in a nicer facility or something? I'm not just sure how much you're bound up by the determinate sentencing.
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, there's a couple of thoughts I have. One, we do offer people treatment, and if they refuse, we extend their incarceration, correct? Yeah. So we do extend it, not for a huge amount of time, but we certainly do extend it as kind of a disincentive in order to get them into treatment. But there's also the impact that would have on our beds if we were to do that. I mean, it would really, I think, increase our demand as well if we were to do something like that.
It's Steve Allen, Director of Behavioral Health Services. Yes, we do, there is a consequence not participating in treatment. Offenders typically get between 30 and 45 extra days of incarceration. Typically, however, we find that folks don't turn down treatment opportunities very often, so I think it's not a significant problem for us. The other problem that was articulated in the legislative auditor's report is that if we increase those periods of incarceration significantly, it really impacts our overall bed problems that we have as we're operating at capacity.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question. Commissioner Benson, you mentioned that you're trying, you understand that we need more treatment, and but it's the cost of putting it on. Is there any idea of what the cost of putting that on is compared to the cost to society of having them out committing crimes?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, I'm certainly not able to quantify that as I sit here today. Obviously, anecdotally, I think we all know that releasing people who have a history of chemical dependency is certainly not a good practice with respect to what's best for public safety. So certainly the more we can bring on, the more beds we can add, and the smoother transition or seamless system that we can create, I think that's only going to further enhance public safety. But I just need to say that let's assume that the committee found $13 million this year annually to add to our CD budget. I can tell you that it would be very, very, very challenging to add that many beds and start to operate an additional 1,200 treatment beds in a 12-month period of time. I don't know that we could conceivably add many staff that are properly licensed given the licensure that's required. So, again, I think the right way to do it is to do it incrementally, and I also think that we've got some work to do with respect to putting that seamless system together, treating them earlier, getting them to minimum, let them participate in that sober environment, and then getting them into the community where they have wraparound services. And we're working as rapidly as we can with our community partners to develop those partnerships as part of this Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Release Program, which we refer to as MNCORP. The other thing that I would just mention with respect to your previous question, Representative Mulray, is while we do add, or we can, it's actually extended incarceration if they refuse to treat or participate in treatment. But on the other end, we're also incenting people through the CIP program where they can actually get out of prison earlier by participating. And we've had a lot of luck with that. And we also have the conditional release program that we just started a couple of years ago, where people who participate in chemical dependency treatment can also be released a bit early. And we're starting to get some history with that program that is encouraging as well. So, again, I think there is some magic to incentives. I think we have to be careful, and I think we have to move slowly. This is not one size is not going to fit all, but certainly conceptually, I think our experience has been positive.
Members, we really need to get to the overview of their budget. We scheduled 15 minutes for this, and now it's 10 to 9 already. Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Hillstrom, Representative Hillstrom, is something burning?
Could just get some numbers later on.
Oh.
Okay, what I'm interested in is if you have any numbers on those that are ordered to treatment, on the recidivism rates between those that actually get access and complete versus those who get no access or who get access and fail.
And you'll get that information to Representative Hillstrom. Something that you want from them and, on the record, Representative Bigham?
Thank you. What I would like to know is, we've heard testimony previous days, about, recidivism rate. And I'm wondering the difference in treatment, the style or numbers, whatever you want to provide, for people that commit, the difference between somebody that commits a new crime and a reoffender that comes back. So do you treat them different if it's deemed that they have a chemical dependency problem? Do you treat them different as a reoffender than as a first-time offender? So if I could get some information regarding that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bigham. We'll get that information to you also. Thank you for your patience, members. Commissioner, I don't know who... thank you, Ms. Larson, for your presentation. Mr. Allen. Commissioner Fabian. And we will take as long as you need to present your budget. We don't finish today. We have all of this whole week is all scheduled for you, so we want to understand your budget clearly. So, Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our agency priorities that contribute to public safety in Minnesota are that we incarcerate the state's most dangerous offenders, we provide opportunities for rehabilitation and change, and we effectively supervise offenders in the community on both probation and supervised release. And the funding recommendations in this budget are really essential to core services related to public safety. The funding will allow us to sustain current operations of our 10 correctional facilities, accommodate the needs of the continued increasing population, and direct much-needed funding to the Minnesota's three correctional delivery systems currently serving thousands of offenders in our communities. We also, it gives us some funding to increase our reentry efforts. So with that, I'll just start with the first slide. And one of the things I think it's important to bring out is that the budget for corrections is really different than the other agencies. Incarceration and supervision of the Minnesota's most dangerous and violent offenders is a core responsibility of state government. And the DOC operations directly impact public safety. We have 24/7 operations that make it impossible to absorb many of the increased costs needed to maintain our operations. As we mentioned in our budget overview, or in our highlights, we have increased in the last 10 years, 83% our population has increased. And the probation population at the same time has increased 32%. And as Deputy Commissioner Benson mentioned, that we have slowed from a high of 10% a year as we increased down to about 3.5% in 2006. It still is increasing. And unlike, you know, some programs, we really have no ability to limit our intake. We can't put people on waiting lists. Yes. And again, unlike some other departments, we really don't have any alternative, meaningful alternative fundings to support our programs. So unfortunately, you're it. The general fund comparisons, if you look in fiscal year 08 and 09, we're asking for a total of $941 million. This is a 10.5% increase from the last fiscal year. And the majority of all of our funding goes to operating our 10 institutions and community services about 26%, and operations support 4%. Deputy Commissioner Benson is going to start out with some of the change items.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're going to go through our change items now and give you some background and description of each of these. The first one that I'm going to talk about is a situation that really rose out of the session last year when we, in the last 3 years, I believe, we've had to come to the legislature and ask for inflationary increases. Because we're a 24/7 operation, we just simply cannot suck up or absorb the inflationary costs that our 1,800 correctional officers and our probation agents, supervisor lease agents, require as a result of the contracts that they negotiate. The inflation was funded through this biennium, but the legislature did not include the $1.975 million in tails. So it's really a tails problem that grew out of the last session, and we need to get that fixed. So that's included in the governor's budget. We've worked with, of course, with Department of Finance on this, and it's $1.975 million per year for $3.95 million for the biennium, and that really is one of those fundamental holes in our budget that we really need to rectify. And if you notice on our slides at the bottom, we indicate where these slides are speaking to with respect to the page number in your budget book. This is on biennial budget page number 11.
Commissioner, can you just go back one second here? I just want to be clear about the in the budget book, if this is a mistake or not, or on page 4. It says the department's biennial budget totals $845.5 million, but that on your slide it appears different, as well as on page 5 of the budget book.
Budget director.
Are these mistakes, or are we just not?
Chairman Tamar, my name is Lisa Cornelius. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Operations Support. The numbers on the slide are base numbers, so it is the general fund numbers along with the change items. The numbers in the book, if you go down to the bottom, will include all funds.
Would you say the last part again?
They will include all funds.
Mr. Carter, can you maybe clarify the...
See, Mr. Chair, I think you're looking on page 4 of the budget book, the $845.5 million, and you're right, I do not think that matches anything in the budget books or the base. We show November forecast spending for 06 and 07 as $841.4 million.
Mr. Carter, I think there might be a typo in the narrative portion on that page.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Cornelius. Commissioner, you want to proceed? Thank you. Oh, Representative Hillstrom had a question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was about the inflation or the tails being added in for this year. In the governor's budget or recommendation, is he in adding inflation ongoing for this department so that it will take care of the inflation problem?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, he is, and we've got a slide that speaks to that as well.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if the governor has done that for any other budget areas, or is it just the Department of Corrections?
Commissioner Benson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not familiar with what he has done for all the other agencies, but I do know that inflation was considered this time for all agencies. It has varied, though, between 24/7 operation and those of us that are not manning or staffing a 24/7 post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue, please.
Mr. Chair and members, the next change item that's included in the governor's budget is for our health care. And, Mr. Chair, as you indicated earlier, you will be spending some time on health care, and we're happy to do that. It's one of those areas that I know you understand that there's drivers that are beyond our control. Some of those things, of course, include prescription medications, which continue to increase each year. We have about 25% of our males and over 50% of our females, about 50% of our juveniles on some type of psychotropic med. We have a population that's probably a little bit sicker or not as healthy as the general population. We have a high percent that's infected with hepatitis C, somewhere between 18 and 20%. We have some, but not a lot, of HIV-positive offenders that we're aware of, around 50. Diabetes and dialysis is another driver. And, of course, the area of chemical dependency and treatment of methamphetamine is much more complicated than, again, just the treatment. There are dental issues. There are psychological issues. There are lots of issues that continue to drive health care costs. The governor's budget has included $1 million in fiscal year 8 and $1.5 million in fiscal year 09, for a total of $2.5 million increase in the base health care budget. The other thing that I would just note, and I've indicated before, that we have more people dying in prison today than we ever have. This past year, we lost 9 to a variety of different diseases, including cancer, heart attack, aneurysm, couple Hep C. Every year we have 2 to 4 that die of end-stage liver disease and kidney failure. We lost one to kidney failure. And I think the numbers are somewhere around 90% of health care costs occur in the last 2 to 3 years of life. So that is another driver of health care costs, because we are keeping people in prison until they die.
We have another question, Commissioner Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize. This is a bit of a rookie question, not having been through this budget previously in my previous terms. But, Commissioner, does the department employ physicians, contract with physicians, and has the department explored partnerships, or does it use partnerships with the medical schools to try to drive some of those costs down? Has any of those has that happened at all in the past?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a good question, and we're proud of the fact that we have a hybrid medical system in Minnesota. It's going on, I think, about its eighth year. We contract quality assurance, utilization management with a private vendor, Correctional Medical Service. They also provide doctors, so they're part of that contract. They also provide a psychiatrist for psychiatry for the department. We also have our own doc on staff that kind of as a checks and balance. We have our own psychiatrist contracted through DHS. We employ all of our nursing staff in all of our facilities. And we used to pay, prior to this contract, we were paying almost 100% of bill charges. We were getting gouged badly because we weren't experts in healthcare and certainly the utilization management piece. But now we do have people that understand how to drive those costs down. So the first year of the contract, you go back to the middle 90s, we actually dropped our healthcare costs by a couple $1 million. And again, I think that we're as efficient as any system out there with respect to decisions being made about what we treat and what we don't treat, what we're constitutionally required to treat in our correctional facilities. So I think we've done a pretty remarkable job of containing those costs, but there are other factors that, again, are beyond our control. We've all heard about the nursing shortage and those salary increases the last 5 years, and they impact us just like they impact everybody else. The other thing we've done is we've added those transitional care unit beds to our Oak Park Heights facility, and they have saved us money. We're putting them in those beds as opposed to sometimes $1,000 to $2,000 hospital bed as soon as we can. We bid this contract. We're in a three-year cycle, and we have the option of adding two additional years, and we have bid it. And both of the times that we bid it, the initial time and the second time, we have marketed this thing to the university system, certainly the old Regents Hospital, St. Paul Ramsey, HCMC. So we have tried to get local interest involved in that contract. We have a relationship, or they have a relationship, with the Blues system, I believe, so that our primary provider is St. Joe's, but there are specialties that require that we go somewhere else. So the other issue here is we're doing as much as we can inside of the facilities. Our special duties, our trips outside the secure perimeter are way down, probably gone down about 70% from the days when we were providing our health care. And we had huge swings from month to month. I was a warden then, and my health care budget would swing back and forth. And we're in a much better position in terms of being able to predict those health care costs. And we have that kind of drilled down to how much per offender. We have a health care per diem. That's a little bit higher for females than males. But in also wrapped up in our health care budget is chemical dependency programming, sex offender programming, and psychological programming. So while the per diem appears high, it includes those programming things too, but we can certainly itemize that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the next change item included in the governor's budget is one for fuel and utilities. We have brought this issue up, I think, the last, again, 3 or 4 years to committee members. It isn't just that the gas pumps in the community that fuel and utilities is increasing. We are experiencing those swings as well. I always say we have 10 little cities inside of our department, and fuel and utilities, again, is one of those things that we have difficulty controlling. We try to control it with respect to those energy-saving issues that we can address. We're going through a process now where we're going to audit all of our facilities for what we call green audits or energy audits. I know when I was a warden at Stillwater 13, 14 years ago, we put all new ballasts in every light in that place. We put traps in the steam lines. We had then, it was NSP, I believe, that came in and did the audit. And now I'm hearing that all of those ballasts are outdated, and we can upgrade and probably save a few bucks off of our energy bills. So we're in the process of doing that. Every new building that we build, the Department of Administration has this piece involved so that new buildings coming on are very energy efficient, consistent with today's technology. We have about 5.5 million square feet of heated space. And we just simply haven't had an increase in this line item for many years. And this past year, our fuel and utilities increased from 05 to 06, it increased 32%. So that's a huge, huge hit, even in spite of the warmer winters. This has impacted us dramatically. So it's $1.5 million a year for a total of $3 million included in the governor's budget for this change item.
Commissioner, we have a question, and I have a question, too, on the Stillwater conversion from steam heat to natural gas. Is that something that we could bond for?
Mr. Chair, we actually did last year. We added three new boilers to Stillwater, and just a little history on that. For 15 years, we were buying excess steam from the L&S King steam plant down in the St. Croix River, and we had a real sweetheart deal with them. It was not only the prison, but Anderson Window had a line running over there, too. But if you recall, part of the governor's initiative here several years ago was to upgrade that plant, and they did that, and now there's no inefficient hot steam that kind of pours into the river anymore. So we had to find a new heat source, and that required us to install our own boilers. The good news is these boilers are very efficient, but nonetheless they cost us some money. And we did take most of that money out of asset preservation, which was in our bonding bill the last couple of cycles. We're also adding a new power plant to the Faribault facility, which is also an energy efficient model, which hopefully will help curb those costs, but nonetheless it's an increase in cost to us.
Representative Paz has a question.
No, it's fine. It's answered.
Okay. Continue, please.
Mr. Chair and members, the next change item is retiree insurance. This is benefit that our correctional officers are entitled to. They've negotiated this, been in place since the early 70s, and basically what it is this is an unfunded line item in our budget. We don't get automatic inflators in this area. We have to pay insurance for retired correctional officers until age of 65, and we're just now approaching the front end of the baby boomer retirement, and I believe this year our projected deficit is going to be somewhere around $500,000 to $700,000 in this budget category, and it's just simply one that we can no longer absorb. So it's $500,000 a year, $1 million for the biennium to try to keep up with this issue that is a an obligation of the department.
Mr. Can you make available to the committee the exact arrangement for retirees, for new hires? This is a problem that's being faced in a lot of different jurisdictions, the kinds of arrangements that you've made with your unions and other communities have made with their unions. And you're saying your testimony today is you can no longer absorb these costs, and so I think we need to see a bigger picture of what's actually going on and what the current arrangement is.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that. Again, while we're part of that negotiation, it's these contracts are all negotiated by Department of Employee Relations. The good news is we have made some inroads the last couple of years in terms of trying to curb those costs a little bit with respect to the contract negotiations. We now require for somebody to get this benefit, they have to at least be with us 10 years. They get 10% a year before they get this benefit. Years ago, you could come in, work 3 years, and retire with your health care paid for. We also got rid of what we referred to as the 55 cliff. In other words, people had to retire at age 55, and then we were paying health care twice. When they retired, we'd pay theirs and then a new employee. So now we've invested a lot in these people, and now that I'm 54, 55 isn't so old anymore. So if they want to work a few years longer and then retire, they can, and I think that saves us money too. But yes, we will get you the benefit package for our correctional officers.
We have a couple of questions here, Representative Mulvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Benson, that raised the issue. Do you know under the federal government's pension tax exemption for where you can have an exemption from federal income for protective service employees, you might call them fire, police, I was surprised, I just learned judges were in that. Do your employees fall within that, and are they intending to try and get into that exemption, and if so, do you know how much that's going to cost us?
Commissioner Benson.
Mr.
And
Chair,
is it in your budget?
Representative Mulvey, I'm almost positive that they do pay state and federal taxes on their retirement, and I'm not aware, at least of the correctional early retirement plan. Now, police and fire might be something different, but in our plan, I'm quite sure that they pay state and federal taxes.
Mr. Chairman, maybe you have to find out. Right now they do. We have a bill, I'm the author, proceeding through for police and fire, but I'm just wondering if, since I found out judges qualify, and your employees might also qualify, so that would be an additional cost if we actually were going to pick them up, and I think it probably should be in the budget if that's going to happen.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulvey, I'm not aware of this. We have been talking with Dewar about what's going to be on the table with respect to negotiations, and I have not heard this with respect to correctional officers, but we will certainly check and get back to you.
Representative, just to explain, it's just an exemption for up to $3,000 to go directly to health care, but for each employee, these count up.
Representative Eastland, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, does the demographic, the age demographic of DOC employees kind of mirror the general public? I mean, when we talk about the baby boom retirement, is there somewhere we could see a picture maybe of 5 and 10 years, what this would look like, where it's going from here, if we're seeing these big jumps?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, yes, we can certainly provide you with the demographics. I think it's pretty close. The good news is I think the correctional officer ranks is probably a little bit younger, but at the same time there are others that are not correctional officers that are probably pretty consistent with that. I think the number is it 700 or 800 retirements, people that would be eligible for retirement in the next 5 years.
Representative.
But we'll get you some detail on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's interesting that Representative Eastland asked about that. I think there are two big elephants in just about every room that we are in. And one of them is the aging demographic, and the other one is impending energy issues, or energy issues that are not only impending but here. And I just want to go back for a moment to the discussion about fuel and utilities. And I just want to ask if you could provide more detailed information about that, because I'd really like to know a little more about what some of the energy-saving measures are, and especially you have that line about limited asset preservation funds, and I'd like to know whether the department has kind of a list of priorities, and if you've costed out what you might be able to save if you were to do each of the items on your list. And, I'm, you know, thinking about whether we should be looking at, you know, if we have one-time money, whether some of it might be well spent in some of those areas, or whether we should be bonding for some of those things.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a good point, and certainly those of you that have been through Stillwater, those of you that saw it the other day, those are circa 1900 windows, and they're very, very inefficient. To replace all the windows to Stillwater, both in the units and industry, would probably be somewhere around $15 million. We did cost this out when I was the warden out there, I believe, in 1995, and back then energy was cheap enough. They said it would take 20 years to pay it back. Now, last year, we installed a prototype window, and we're getting a cost on it, and part of that audit is going to be, does it make sense today, given energy costs, to invest in windows? I absolutely believe that we're going to find that the payback is going to be probably somewhere around 10 or 12 years in terms of what we might save. So I think that's a point well taken. And anytime we have any extra money, again, given the age of our buildings and our facilities, it goes to asset preservation. We did end up with only $5 million in asset preservation in the last bonding cycle. And for an agency our size, that was tough. But on the other hand, we were expanding. We have been expanding. I say the same thing about this as I did about chemical dependency beds. We were so busy adding beds to our system to accommodate the unprecedented growth that some of the asset preservation needs did take a backseat to just managing the growth. But we can get you numbers. Our finance department did an excellent job last year of laying out the increases at a couple of different facilities in energy costs. So that is readily available, and we'll get you some additional information.
And Commissioner, do you have those projects prioritized?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes. Every year we go through our needs out there, and we prioritize them, but every year it changes. There are more roofs that leak. There are more boilers that need to be replaced. There are sewer systems that need to be upgraded. So it's a little bit like projections. It's kind of a moving target, but there's asbestos issues. We had a mold issue that you heard about at Oak Park Heights. So we will get you our list of priorities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Harley Nelson. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Community Services for the Department. The next program is a community program costs that are currently occurring. You heard about the CIP program up in Willow River being expanded. We've expanded it by 90 beds. That is happening this month with the bodies going in there for treatment. They'll be coming out in July. We need about six additional intensive supervised release agents to supervise those offenders. It's a very important part of that program. The supervision that takes place is very intensive. They are seeing them at least a minimum of 4 to 5 times a week in their home at the work site. And they're doing some electronic monitoring, and they're doing drug testing. And so we need those agents for FY08 and then FY09. We're going to add an additional 4 agents. So it'll be $1 million. The other program that is...
Commissioner, can I just ask you a question about that? Where did you get the $100,000 per agent figure?
We've been using that for a number of years now. We can only expand it as a supervised release in 2005. The reason it's that high is that we're getting the most experienced agents. Excuse me. And in addition, the costs of transportation are high and the strength, but they are the most senior agents that are coming into this program, and that's where we're recruiting them for this program, because they need that kind of experience to do this type of intensive supervision. So this has been a figure that we've used for the last couple of years to support an intensive agent.
Yes, I'm curious because some of the counties who hire very experienced probation officers, it costs them quite a bit less than $100,000 per agent. So I'm just wondering if you can break out those figures maybe for the committee at a later time here.
Great. We'll break those out for you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
The conditional release program that started, and we now have about 35 offenders out. We had some temporary funding for that. We filled three of those agent positions. And we believe that by summer we will need to fill the other three. So we're looking at about 600,000 or six agents there to do the CRP program. This is the offenders that go through treatment in the institution. They get out. We provide that intensive supervision also, which is a very important part of that component. The interstate compact costs. We are for about 4 years now members of the new interstate compact. There's all 50 states. And territories, a couple free territories are part of that. There's additional fees for this. They're going to do it more structured. They're going to monitor the cases better. We're looking at about $35,000 in annual fees. There's some additional staff that we need to monitor this. There's some information, national database that we have to participate in that will be coming up soon. And we have some transportation costs and juveniles as part of the interstate compact. Predatory offender risk assessment, community notification unit. That's an area that is both the civil commit and the notification. Those numbers have increased dramatically. We're looking at about 600 offenders out of the 1,500 sex offenders incarcerated that we're screening. That screening goes down to committees. We need staff to review those, to do reports. We're referring about 165 cases. I think last year that number looks like it's going up. They've been referred to county attorneys. Potential civil commit. And so we also have the judiciary as part of the last legislative session. We have judges that review these cases to make a legal opinion as to how they expect them to be referred for civil commit or not.
We have a...
I apologize for my voice here today.
That's okay.
I'm kind of coming down with something that my wife gave it to me. Yes.
Representative Mulder?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The community notification, the increase there, do we reimburse the cities for their costs on community notification? And if so, are we increasing that reimbursement with the extra numbers they're receiving?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman.
The extra costs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, we do not reimburse them. We assist them. In public notification meetings for level 3 sex offenders, there's about 100 of them out on the street right now that move around. So we assist with those meetings, but we do not reimburse them for notification. There's many more sex offenders. There's 14,000 predatory offenders out there. And as they move around, they have costs at the local level. We also have costs if we provide information for those law enforcement agencies as they go about their notification, whether based on whether they're level 1, 2, or 3. There's different amounts of notification that take place. But there are additional costs to local law enforcement that are not reimbursed by the Department of Corrections. And also BCA plays an important part for the registration of all sex offenders in the state of Minnesota.
Please proceed.
You've seen this graph before, and again, unique in Minnesota is that the most dangerous offenders are in prison, but the vast majority are sanctioned at the local level. So I did add a total on here, so I'd be able to add up felonies when asked what the total is. I just wanted to remind you about the 100 and 31,000 people that are under some kind of supervision in Minnesota, plus an additional 4,000 that are on supervised release from the prisons. Again, we have the three delivery systems, and I just wanted again to set the stage for the request for funding for the three delivery systems. And again, that this is why corrections really does work in Minnesota very well, is because we have, such a commitment at the local level. Again, the Department of Corrections does, in all non-Community Corrections Act counties, which are 55 counties, the Department of Corrections provides the felony supervision. And we also contract with 27 other counties to also do the juvenile and misdemeanor supervision. And as you know, the Community Corrections Act counties provide all of the supervision in those jurisdictions. And the county probation officer, and you always hear CPO, that those counties provide juvenile and misdemeanor supervision. And just a few issues on what has been happening with offender supervision and management. Obviously we had a huge budget crisis back in 2003. And at that time, all three delivery systems had a reduction in the funding that they received, despite a very significant increase in the number of probationers that they were supervising. And all the new funding that came last biennium was really very categorical, and it was designated for specific things like ISI, or intensive supervision, agents to supervise the high-risk sex offenders. The new funding that we're proposing would be contingent upon all three delivery systems implementing evidence-based best practices. And we've had a leadership group across the three delivery systems that have been working on making sure that all jurisdictions are providing evidence-based practices. So as the in the three delivery systems, what we're looking at is a $2.8 million increase to the community corrections subsidy, which would be $5.6 million over the biennium. The Department of Corrections would be looking at $600,000 a year for $1.2 million. And the county probation officer subsidy would be $600,000 a year, $1.2 million. This funding is really a key part of making reentry a success. Currently with the high caseload, it's really, really difficult for agents to be able to manage their caseload efficiently. When you're looking at reentry and getting them in touch with all of the different services that they need, you need to know your caseload. You need to, know what exact services they need. The caseloads, especially for, regular supervision caseloads. And when you talk about regular, when we put sex offenders on specialized, that leaves you the murderers and the aggravated robbers, and really the lower risk type of offenders are on group supervision, so you might have one probation officer to 250 people. What we're looking at is giving resources to these three delivery systems so that they can very responsibly supervise their cases. The second part of funding for the three delivery systems would be looking at a $9 million increase in sex offender management and supervision. And basically what happened in 2005, the legislature mandated a task force to look at providing standards for the supervision of all sex offenders. This was done after the legislative auditor came in and did a report, recommended that professionals across the state get together and decide on what appropriate standards of supervision for sex offenders are. Also to look at treatments, to look at polygraphs, to look at assessments and ensure that they are best practices to ensure that all counties are doing them. So what that report, you will be getting that. It's due to the legislature on February 7th. And the preliminary recommendations in that are that counties need 40 more agents statewide to supervise sex offenders according to the standards. That would be 20 agents in 2008 and 28 more agents in 2009. The legislative auditor's report also made it very clear that we need to do research on what sex offender programs work, which ones don't, what type of programming it should be. The same with polygraph. There's wide use of polygraph with sex offender treatment across the state, and there's no standards. There's no standards for the sex offender treatment. And so this group that we put together is proposing those type of standards and research and evaluation for looking at all of that. So we're looking at $500,000 in 08 to do what is recommended by the auditor's report and also by this work group, and $1 million in 2009. Also, we're looking at community outpatient treatment. This again is part of the reentry, and that would be grants to the community to increase the sex offender treatment that this research is saying works, and so would be granted to counties in $500,000 in 08 and $1 million in 09.
Commissioner Fabian, we'll take a couple quick questions here, and then we'll adjourn. We'll run a few minutes over, and then have you come back tomorrow morning if you could and finish this up for Commissioner Benson as we talk about reentry. But Representative Cornish had a question, and Hilstrom.
It's probably more of a comment. In certain areas, we probably all got biases or favoritism towards certain parts of the budget, and this is one of mine, and I'll tell you a quick story I've often debated about telling you or not, but many years ago, my grandpa went into prison, first to St. Cloud and then to Stillwater. He just screwed up. He's a hell of a nice guy, but screwed up his life with chemical dependency. And while he was in Stillwater, he wrote a diary that I still have, and in reading it, when he left Stillwater, he had all the religion, all the right things to say, and the probation officers, thought that he might have a chance of making it, but when he got home, he didn't have a job. The family had been kind of alienated by his behavior, so he didn't have anybody to turn to, and it was very obvious from reading his prison diary that he was, you can just see it day to day, his will getting less and less, no visitors, no probation agent, nobody to talk to turn to. And so this reentry program means a lot to me when we come to this part of the budget, because if he would have had somebody to rely on or talk to or for some encouragement, keep it up, I really have a faith that he could have, he got the monkey off his back and made a go of it. So I think the reentry is, these programs are, they're really important to just have somebody to talk to and encourage and keep on the right path. And so I would encourage us when we get to this part to, do what we can for that. So.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Appreciate that. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sex offender treatment grants is something I'm particularly interested in. About 52% of the level 3 sex offenders all live in Hennepin County. And 40% of those level 3s were sent to prison from counties other than Hennepin County. Will the $1.5 million that you have in your budget for sex offender treatment alleviate that concentration for certain neighborhoods in Hennepin County, or will it aggravate it?
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Hilstrom, I believe it will eliminate or relieve it. We are looking at, putting that across the state. It won't just be, and that's part of the reason I know that they end up in your county is because treatment is available. So we're looking to put it other places so they can go back where they came from.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Representative Hilstrom, some of those level 3s are no longer under supervision, so we would have no ability to go in and force treatment on those level 3s that are no longer under supervision.
Okay, so we'll finish up tomorrow morning, and then we'll spend the rest of the morning on reentry efforts. Thank you, members. Meeting's adjourned.